the headlines. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution calls on the nation to take part in the upcoming presidential election. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says Israel's deadly strikes on Gaza may constitute war crimes. And China accuses the U.S. of spreading conspiracy theories and disinformation as a theory resurfaced the coronavirus emerged from a Wuhan laboratory. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has urged citizens to take part in the upcoming presidential election. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei called on people to vote for whoever candidate they believe is their right choice. He urged voters to turn a deaf ear to those who try to promote voter apathy by creating the impression that going to the polls would be futile. He said those individuals do not care about the nation. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader touched upon the process of establishing the eligibility of presidential hopefuls. He said the Constitutional Council did its job and finalized the eligible candidates for the race. Ayatollah Khamenei also expressed his gratitude to all those registered for the election, saying many of them definitely did so due to a sense of responsibility. Political commentators say it, Mohammad Barandi says, despite controversies, Iran's election process is strongly democratic.
The circumstances in our region right now necessitate a high turnout in order to strengthen Iran at this crucial turning point. There is a very large degree of democracy in Iran. The issue of presidential candidates in Iran and the Guardian Council has always been controversial. And whether they are the government or the Guardian Council or any other element of the state makes right choices or right decisions or wrong decisions, that's one issue. But the main issue is that there are debates, there will be debates. There is a strong element of democracy involved in Iran, unlike most other countries in the world, where it's basically a facade. And that should be strengthened, and people should exercise their right to vote, both to choose the better candidate among the options that are available, but also to strengthen the country during these very sensitive times in the region.
UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says Israel's attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip may constitute war crimes. Bachelet made the remark in the UN Human Rights Council's special session on the humanitarian situation in Gaza on Thursday. She said there is no evidence that civilian buildings in Gaza hit by Israeli strikes were being used for military purposes. She called on Israel to halt evicting Palestinians in the occupied territories. The session was held at the request of Palestine and Pakistan, demanding a probe into human rights violations during the recent Israeli aggression. The investigation will be carried out by an independent international commission. Nearly 255 Gazans were killed and over 1,900 injured in 11 days of the Israeli aggression before a ceasefire last Friday. Nearly half of the victims are women and children. In Syria, vote counting is underway following the country's presidential election held on Wednesday. Syria's Supreme Judicial Committee for Elections says the process began immediately after the closure of polling stations. It says counting is being done in the presence of the candidates, representatives, and the media. Results are expected to be announced by Friday evening. Syrians inside the country cast their ballots at more than 12,000 polling stations nationwide on Wednesday. Last week, Syrian refugees and expatriates also cast an early ballot at Syrian embassies in many countries, including Iran. Incumbent President Bashar al-Assad, Abdullah Saloom Abdullah, a former state minister, and Mahmoud Marey, an opposition figure, are the three candidates running for president. Assad secured a landslide victory in the last presidential election held in 2014.
Masses of Syrians rushed to take part in the country's presidential election. Ballot boxes opened at 7 a.m., signaling the beginning of the process, which allows citizens to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the state's next president for the next 7 years.
What you are seeing on TV screens shows Syrians' love to their country, sovereignty, and dignity. The West will be ashamed when they see those images. They will realize that all their attempts to mislead Syrians and falsify facts were not fruitful. 125 journalists came from many countries to cover the election. We told them they can cover from any area and only asked them to report professionally.
There is a democratic atmosphere here. No one interferes in the election. Each Syrian votes for the candidate he finds suitable. The process is a battle just like the military ones. The Syrians are proving to the world that they are capable of choosing the president that they want.
Over 12,000 electoral centers were set up. In Syria, more than 18 million people are eligible to vote. Incumbent President Bashar al-Assad and Syria's First Lady Esma al-Assad cast their ballots in Douma, once a terrorist stronghold, before the Syrian army liberated it in 2018. Assad said Syrians' rallies in support of the election is a good enough response to the statements made by Western countries that rejected the election process. Iran's ambassador to Syria recommended the West to respect Syrians' decision.
We recommend them to respect the decision, to respect the decision of the people, the Syrian people, and they claim that the democracy, they claim to respect the sovereignty of other countries. And we recommend them to be honest to their claiming.
We came here at the invitation of the Syrian government to observe the election. The election is fair and free. We were amazed by the large number of Syrians coming to vote, which signals the Syrian love to their government.
Syrian expatriates have already voted on the 20th of May across the world. Syrians outside government-controlled territories will not be able to vote, such as in SDF-controlled, terrorist-controlled, and Turkish and U.S.-occupied parts of Syria.
So many countries have stood against Syria since 2011. They have tried to destroy the country by toppling its president forcibly and eliminating its army by supporting terrorist groups. But here they are today. Syrians are voting and expressing their right to independent decision-making, telling those countries, "We decide our future." Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations has called for bringing an end to shielding terrorist groups in Syria. Majid Takht-Davanchi denounced the categorization of terrorists as good, bad, and moderate. He added that Syria's unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity must be restored. He said this could be achieved only through ending the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights and the withdrawal of uninvited foreign forces. The Iranian UN envoy warned against politicizing humanitarian assistance to Syria and condemned the use of food and medicines as weapons. Takht-Davanchi urged the removal of unilateral sanctions on Syria, branding them as immoral and unlawful. He said such measures prolong the suffering of ordinary people. China has accused the United States of spreading conspiracy theories and disinformation after a theory resurfaced that the coronavirus emerged from a laboratory in China's Wuhan province. Beijing's reaction came after Washington increased pressure for a new probe into the origins of COVID-19. This after a World Health Organization mission to China returned inconclusive findings. The Wuhan Institute of Virology returned to the spotlight following a report in the Wall Street Journal citing U.S. intelligence, which said three laboratory workers in China's Wuhan province had been hospitalized with coronavirus-like symptoms in November 2019. It was a month before the pandemic's first declared case. Beijing denied the report, saying it was disrespectful to the WHO investigation to revive the theory. China said the move would risk undermining global solidarity to fight the virus. Beijing said if Washington wants full transparency, it should open its laboratories to WHO experts. Political commentator Inner Tangen says the U.S. is using recycled facts to spread disinformation about the origin of COVID-19.
Joe Biden is thinking about the midterm elections, and he does not want to take this head on. I mean, the science is saying that it's inconclusive. They don't know. It's highly doubtful that it came from a man-made, lab of any type. But, you know, there are people out there, especially on the Trump side and bipartisan support on the Democratic side, too, saying, well, if we don't know, maybe China did it. And that's a little bit of a leap of faith there. To say, I don't know, therefore somebody is responsible. But, keep in mind, these are all recycled facts. report that three people who worked at the virology lab, which employs hundreds of people, were sick in November, was actually brought up in March of 2020. So this idea that it's somehow new isn't true. It's just recycled, it's convenient. There's also a very strong desire not to have to confront the issue of the pandemic itself and how it was handled by various governments around the world, especially the U.S. And to a certain degree India, which is now having a major problem.
The COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll on India as the number of infections and fatalities from the virus keeps rising. The country recorded a whopping 3,800-plus new deaths in the past 24 hours. Now the overall fatalities from the disease hover around 320,000. More than 211,000 new infections were also recorded, bringing the total caseload to well over 27 million. India is second only to the United States in terms of infections. The spike is due to the spread of an aggressive new wave of the virus in the South Asian country. In the past weeks, the World Health Organization says the Indian coronavirus variant has now been detected in more than 53 countries around the world. Australia's state of Victoria has been ordered to enter a 7-day lockdown amid growing concerns over the spread of a new coronavirus variant. The stay-at-home order is being applied to more than 5 million people in the state capital, Melbourne, and surrounding areas. Schools and restaurants will be closed, and public gatherings will be banned. The restrictions come amid the detection of 26 new cases of COVID-19 in Victoria. Officials link the new cases to the new coronavirus variant first detected in India. They blame a sluggish vaccine rollout and hotel quarantine failures for the new outbreak in the country's second populous state. This is the fourth time Victoria is going under lockdown since the start of the pandemic. EU leaders ignore a plea from the World Health Organization to prioritize the vaccination of vulnerable people around the world from COVID-19 before inoculating children. Living in the 27-nation bloc, health experts warned that the EU strategy could backfire due to the rise of new variants. Jerome Hughes reports.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries. The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organisations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries. EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Unions fear a social bomb is about to go off in Italy as millions of jobs will be wasted when a COVID-linked firing ban is about to expire in a few weeks. Unionists are accusing the government of just listening to entrepreneurs' demands. Max Gili reports from Rome.
A social bomb is about to explode in Italy, according to the country's three major trade unions, CGIL, CISL and UIL. Around 2 million jobs are at risk due to a planned end to a ban on individual and collective dismissals on July the 1st. Wheel Union warned on Wednesday the measure had been adopted by the government to counter the economic crisis triggered by the COVID-19.
It is going to be a social bomb for the Italian society, with workers and families paying the highest price for the COVID crisis. The government must give the workers a response in order to stop the social bomb going off with social security cushions.
Also, the Bank of Italy has predicted severe consequences following the end of the firing ban, even though its estimate is set at 500,000 jobs wasted. Unions have accused the Draghi government of just listening to industrial employers' body Confindustria, with businesses having been received three-quarters of government COVID relief.
However, not everybody agrees on the fact that millions of jobs will be wasted when the firing ban ends. Some analysts have argued the layoffs will be fairly unlikely, with the Italian economy set to significantly improve in the coming months.
I believe we have to support Italy's economic recovery by investing on digital innovation and environment-related projects. We have to focus on workers, but also on the country's companies, or there won't be any recovery. We don't have a crystal ball. It's hard to say if there will be an economic recovery any soon. The only thing we can do is to put together a number of tools to enhance it.
Despite the daunting socio-economic challenges that the pandemic has been posed for Italy, the country still accounts for 17% of industrial production in the European Union, making it second only to Germany at 30%. Rome's economic recovery will very much depend on its ability to spend over 200 billion euros it is set to get from the EU's COVID-19 recovery. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Among the highest qualities of Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, were infallibility and purity from deviation and atrocities. Indeed, infallibility is a favor from Allah the Most High. He grants it to whomever he wills from his servants, whose hearts he tests with belief, whom he purifies and chooses to carry out his message and reform his creatures. Infallibility is among the firm beliefs with the Shiites and one of the basic principles for the imamate with them.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we find in the historical texts of the Muslims that there are a very many conversations and dialogues between the divinely appointed imams and the people, their friends, their companions, and their relatives. We find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam, had a good opportunity to be able to have these conversations and these dialogues with the people and the Muslims in general. And so interestingly, Imam al-Baqir speaks about a whole host of different things, ranging from philosophy to theology, from history to the interpretation and the verses of the Holy Quran, as well as Islamic ethics and morality. Now, when specifically talking about Islamic ethics and morality, we find that Imam al-Baqir had interesting and golden conversations with his companions. In one such instance, we find that the companions of Imam al-Baqir asked him about certain negative qualities which Muslims should refrain from. In response to the question in this conversation, Imam al-Baqir says to his companions, "One of the negative qualities is as follows: whoever asks more than his right is worth deprivation." Again, whoever asks more than his right is worth deprivation. Now, when we think about this, it might seem to be a little bit harsh. Well, who can be worth of deprivation? Who can be worth being deprived of something? But here we need to keep in mind the first part of the statement that Imam al-Baqir says, which is, whoever asks for more than their right. Meaning it is our right to receive 5 coins. Now that is what our right is, that is what our due is, that is what we are supposed to be given, that is what is the just measure which is to be allotted to us, 5 coins. But then we go ahead and we ask for more. We fight. We become greedy. We become jealous. We become arrogant and proud. We become aggressive. No, what is supposed to be my just recompense of 5 coins is not enough for me. I want more. I want more than what is my right. Now, this kind of individual is worth of deprivation. They are worth being deprived of that which they want more. Of course, humbly suggesting and being appropriate and kind and proper and respectful in requesting for more, there's nothing wrong with that. But when you are aggressively and offensively asking for more than what is your right, you're being pushy and bossy and obnoxious. No, that individual is worth of deprivation. And it is interesting when a person who is unjustly asking for more than what is their right, when they are deprived from that which is more than their right, they end up coming back to what is their due right. A beautiful, simple, but very profound and thought-provoking statement which we find in this dialogue from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La
ilaha illallah. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
There's a nice essay by Toshiko Murata in the book called Islamic Spirituality. She's Japanese. She studied in Tehran, and apparently she also attended some of the lectures or might have seen Allama Tabatabai as well, right? In geology, an article on that, right? We read about angels in the du'as. Have we really questioned, asked? It really requires that. Now, this place is not where we can talk everything now 9:30 happens, loads of emails, Maulana went 3 minutes over, 4 minutes over, right? No, it's, and I respect that. No. And it has to be there. Tomorrow is a weekday. You know, people have to go to work, right? So everything needs to be, but it requires, okay, now we could say that, okay, we are having classes upon the sciences of the names of the Lord, right? We have that available for you. Then we have to really participate in it. Not that the classes is there, five people come and attend, you know. The opportunity is given, nobody attends. Then we are not really true followers of Baqirain and Sadiqain.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Beaker. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhbakhna Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There's a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it was interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab.
She wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic, which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks about you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it, but they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was...
Actually, we're going to touch that on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste, this harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like, watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman, who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes. The others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually a very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting, because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying, because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it, because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually fund, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently free, they were independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR stunt, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss some more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama-style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary now, with Emna, who is supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Really? Why is that?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator, Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the point that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. In the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Jawahara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. And can you explain that?
Yes, I wanted to ask Catherine, could you give us
Women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards. And which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. The sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Jawahara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the terrorist stereotype and work together. What did you make of that scene?
I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that
the Western both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't just the Muslim problem.
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Jawahara says, "This is awful. This is not what my father taught me. This is not what is in the Quran. We must fight it."
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament, and especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then We have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? It's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? So briefly there was an issue of terrorism.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off. And it's a blueprint, but, it's a compounding of everything. All the issues that, other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, the discussion, secularism, Islamism, what do we do? Could we find, another way? I think her silence, speaks volume, really. And it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of, radicalism? What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, here it's Islam, but, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, preaches, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, is this attempt to have pluralism. And this is what I heard, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they need to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. And I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media. That kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. Even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
We're nearing the end of the film and this programme now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to see in the documentary also?
What would I... Well, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Joel Arab was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly, when the president, or was he the prime minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election. Suddenly the constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would...
So would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
You? Oh, yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the